I just slipped through an exam, and you're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
And now we are joined, as I mentioned before, by the magnanimous Mr. Carl Stead. Modena, Carl, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Nice to be with you in Dunedin, though I'm not in Dunedin. But
it's great to have you on, Carl. You're coming to us from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, and I hear things are a little bit rainy up there.
Yeah, it's pouring.
Damn. Are you a rainy day sort of guy?
I don't mind a rainy day. Yes, it's quite soothing, really. But and it's nearly always warm when it rains.
Mm-hmm. I bet in Auckland for sure. Down here, not so much. But you're quite a renowned person in our literary world in Aotearoa, and you know, Dunedin is renowned for its literature. When you were kind of coming up, did you read a lot of the Dunedin literature?
Well, I certainly read James K. Baxter, as everyone who's interested in New Zealand literature did, and of course I had dealings with Charles Brash, who was the editor of Landfall, and I had things published in Landfall, so I always felt there was a strong literary connection with Dunedin.
Mm-hmm. It's cool that I guess has transcended time, because now the New Zealand Young Writers Festival takes place in Dunedin, which is really, really, really refreshing.
Very good.
But where would you say is maybe the literature capital of New Zealand now?
Well, you know, I'm an egotist. I think the literature capital is wherever I happen to be.
It's in your home.
But seriously, I don't know, because I don't really keep up with, I used to be keep up with New Zealand writing, but there's so much of it now I can't really. But obviously Dunedin's still a centre, Wellington's still a centre, so is Auckland. I mean, it's going on everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting about there's just too much now. I feel like that's the same with every kind of thing, like movies, TV, music, you know, the internet. While it's, you know, opened the floodgates quite a lot, the flood is quite overwhelming.
It is overwhelming, yes, especially at my age. I just, you know, I feel as though I have to let the world go by without me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm feeling that now, to be honest.
Already?
Yeah, already. Oh, man. So you just put out a new book called Table Talk, which features stories, reviews, essays, and opinions, and a play. It's quite a lot of different subject matter in here. How did you structure Table Talk so it flowed organically to you?
Well, it's just an assembly of things that I've written that haven't been republished and I felt should be republished. So the first is literary nonfiction, the first section. Then the next one is short stories. And it finishes with the play, which is actually a version. I don't call it a translation. I call it an approximation of a famous French play by Jean Racine. But beyond that, there's no structure at all, really. It's just an assembly of things for somebody of literary interest. It's really the kind of book that people who form book groups are likely to be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can imagine a book group who would have this book and they would meet and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And also I imagine there's some diehard CK Stead fans who are extremely pleased that you've put out some new material. Would your fan base have any kind of nickname? Like, you know, Beyonce has her bees, Nicki Minaj has the Barbies. What would your fan base be called?
Well, I can't imagine. I don't want to invent a name for them at the moment because, no, I, I, No idea.
The Steadfasters? Yeah, that's all I can think of.
Well, Steadfast will be fine, yes.
Well, speaking of structure, the first thing in the book is an interview from 2019 with writer, critic and author Mark Broach. What about this interview made you feel it should be the first thing that the reader should read?
Well, because he covered a lot of ground, a lot of my life and a lot of the things I'd done, and so in a way it is an introduction to me in general. If you don't know anything about me, that interview would tell you quite a bit about me.
Well,
and also, it's, you know, the questions bring out your personality to a certain extent, so it's a good way to introduce a book, I think.
I think it really it did a great job of introducing you as a person to me, because I'd never heard of you, mate.
Never heard of you. You're not alone in that.
But to those who know, I mean, it's you're one of the best writers in the country. So, in that interview, you touch on poetry and how, since your 50s, you've kind of lost the need for inspiration in poetry, and you have a sort of poetry mode. Do you do the same thing when you're writing short stories or critiquing something?
No, I think poetry is peculiar. As I say, I think I say there that when I was young, there did have to be something like inspiration that came mysteriously from who knows where. But as I got older, quite a lot older, I could put myself into what I thought of as poetry mode, which might begin simply by reading a lot of other people's poetry, but that would kind of settle me into that mode, and then at that point I could begin trying to write poems. And this is always an element of trial and error in poems. They either do, you know, they do work or they don't, and you have to be able to distinguish between, otherwise you just put out a lot of crap.
Yeah, you do. That's a very real possibility, I imagine. I really like in that same question, you talk about just kind of the innate ability for, you know, youthful creativity to put out such incredible work. But the problem with youthful creativity is it doesn't have stamina, which is something that you need to learn alongside wisdom and cunning in order to keep producing good material at your... when you get older, I guess, which I thought was really, really fascinating. Do you need to add more elements to that mix other than wisdom, experience, and cunning when you get into your 70s and you're still making stuff?
Well, no, you aggregate experience, and that becomes a kind of, not a substitute, but... it makes up for maybe the loss of youthful fire. Something has to make up for the loss of youthful fire. And what it is normally is a lot of experience, a lot of learning how to do things well and how not to do them well, how to do them badly. And wisdom is an element in poetry, but maybe not the strongest element, but it's got to be there.
Does listening to your critics come into it at all?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's probably wise to listen to your critics, but if you don't sort of admire them much in the first place, you tend to dismiss them. If they like your work, you think that they're very, very wise, very good critics, and you tend to dismiss them if they don't like your work. So, I mean, you know, it's just part of the process.
Do you think because the New Zealand literature community, when I guess like from the maybe the 50s to the 90s, you know, it was very small, I imagine that there was quite a lot of infighting and personal drama. I mean, there's a really good story in Table Talk about your relationship with Maurice Shadbolt, who was a New Zealand writer. And I think one time you were giving a lecture and you kind of made a comment about his writing style, and he took that very personally. And then those people kind of critique your poetry. Does that make you tend to listen to them a bit less?
Well, Shadbolt and I, the problem was we got on well together. We could be friends. We were friends when we were in London together in the 50s. Mm. And from time to time, we'd meet up and be friends. But the problem was that the problem with Shadbolt was I never could quite admire his work. So if I tended to say anything negative about him, people would say, well, you're just jealous. And I suppose I was jealous of his success, but I didn't always think his success was deserved. So my feelings about him were always mixed. And I didn't always quite admire him, but I could enjoy his company. We could have great times together.
Mm.
Very strange, really. And it's a bit, it's a difficult thing. If you're friends with a writer and you can be friends and good chums, you know, good mates, but you don't actually much like what he writes. It's a difficulty.
I can imagine. I mean, sometimes you've got to bite your tongue in that respect, but it seems like you didn't, and I think you're all the better for it. Does being both a creative writer and professional critic lean on you being very hard on yourself when you're creating non-critic literary works? Or has being a critic created a great deal of, self-trust and confidence?
Well, the thing is that I grew up at the time where the literary world was sort of dominated by T.S. Eliot, who was a poet and a critic. And there was the fashion then, really, was that you had a kind of duty, if you wrote criticism, to be honest. Even if, you know, even if it offended people, you had to. So I grew up with that, and I had to learn, I suppose, not just to be critical, but to curb the tendency, because, you know, you're not always right. It's amazing over time how you find you have one opinion of something, and it over years have passed, and then you go back to it and you have a completely different opinion, which undermines both opinions, because which one's right? I mean, there were novels, for example, a novel by I've forgotten her name now, but quite a famous novel that when I was a teenager I absolutely loved. I really thought it was one of the great novels of all time. And then when I went back to it in my 50s and read it again, I thought it was dreadful. I thought it was absolute crap, you know. So when that happens to you, you learn by that you mustn't have too much confidence at any one moment in what you think of something. You better curb what you think and put it somewhat tentatively.
So when you were reviewing that, so when you were re-looking at that old book from your childhood, there was no element that you were like, that was nostalgia blinding you? It was just pure, this is trash?
Well, I could see, I mean, it's very well written, and it's by Emily Bronte, and I could see it was very marvelously well written, but it has this character, Heathcliff, that it seems he's supposed to be romantic, marvelous romantic figure, and he just seemed to my middle age, he just seemed utterly ridiculous and worthless, you know? So I couldn't feel the romanticism that she felt about Heathcliff. It's the novel is Wuthering Heights.
Oh, I've heard of that. I haven't read it, but yeah. I've heard very good things. It's somewhat of a classic.
Probably say in the local accent of Wuthering Heights.
Wuthering Heights. There's a really cool story in Table Talk called A Short History of New Zealand, and it follows a Kiwi expat who's forced to come home for a funeral, and for the first few pages he's really giving Aotearoa a tough time for its simplicity and, I guess, localness compared to London, where he's used to. Now, you yourself lived in London. Were you ever the, self-effacing Kiwi traveller?
I don't know about self-effacing.
Self-effacing is effacing New Zealand, not yourself.
Being abroad, if you're a New Zealander, always makes you recognize the limitations of your place. I suppose wherever you come from, you look back on it wherever you are, and you make comparisons, and they're not always favorable. But, that's just a part of... also part of growing up, if your process of growing up includes travel. So, I'm not sure what you're asking me.
I guess I was going to say, did you have a point where you were travelling that you were like, oh man, I can't stand New Zealand, it's so boring and so dull compared to all these exotic places,
Yes, sometimes I felt like that, yeah. Mm. I love being in France, but I wasn't fluent enough in the language to enjoyed completely, and I loved being in London when I was there. I did my PhD in Bristol. I loved living in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always drawn back to New Zealand. I wanted to be, I had the feeling when I was young that a New Zealand literature was developing, and I'd had Alan Kernow and Frank Sargeson as kind of mentors, and they were a kind of ideal for me and made me want to come back and be part of what they were creating.
Mm. Well, that's cool that that brought you back. Otherwise, if that didn't bring you back, you might still be in Europe?
Yeah, well, if that hadn't brought me back, I think I would still be in Europe, yeah.
Mm. It'd be a whole different life.
One of my daughters moved to London and... with a Kiwi and married there and has children there, and she'll never come home, but she comes home on visits often and loves coming back, but she's really, she's cemented into her life in Europe, in London,
mm-hmm.
in publishing. So, it would always have been possible for me to do that. There were always academic jobs I could have had in the UK, but I always felt I wanted to come back.
I think the cool thing about New Zealand as opposed to those other places is that there's always space in those, there's always space in the creative scene to make a huge impact, which I don't think would be as nearly as easy as doing the same in a place like London or France, I want to thank you for your time. And what were you going to say, sorry?
No, I just saying probably you're right. That's all.
Alrighty, thank you. thank you for coming on the program today, Carl. It's been fantastic chatting with you. I do want to know, what are your plans for 2025?
Well, I'm so old, it's dangerous for me to make any plans, and I should probably say my plan for 2025 is to die. Well, I'm 92. I mean, it's not unrealistic. But if I survive, I do have thoughts of going back briefly on a visit to London and France.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no further writing plans. I think I've finished writing.
You're done? You're done and dusted?
I think so, yeah.
All right.
But, of course, one should never say never.
Well, in 2028, when you put out your next book, I'd be very keen to chat with you.
Well, if that happens, I'll really enjoy meeting you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carl. It was fantastic chatting with you. Ka kite.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, folks. That was Carl Stead, a.k.a. CK Stead. We're talking about his new book, Table Talk. It's a really, really awesome compilation read full of opinions, stories, critiques, and a play at the very end. All right, Carl has requested the track The Seekers with The Carnival Is Over, so we're going to play that. And then at 9:30, we have the Surf Report coming up. This is The One. Stay tuned. Love you. Bye.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast, but find more at r1.co.nz.